Well, good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see so many people having arrived for Data Ecology Symposium 2012. Data Ecologies is a series of lecture meetings that deal with the ways real and abstract system interrelate. The last one was 2009 in Brussels, and the topic was money as abstraction. Looking at money as an abstraction and also the value as something real. And the main aim of the series is to link between theory and artistic practice and also give space for exchange, reflection, and even stimulation, we hope. This year's symposium, The Map and the Territory, intends to look at notation techniques and their possibilities of, to use in artistic practice, to map artistic practice, with the intention to search for ways to write down, in a wider sense, processes, tasks, and work stages in order to create a possible toolkit for transmission. So Data Ecologies was created as a platform for exchange, reflection, and stimulation, as I mentioned, with input from experts in diverse areas related to the topic. The next 2 days, 8 experts in their field will present their findings related to the topic from theoretical as well as practical points of views. With the title, The Map and the Territory, the symposium attempts to examine, look at, and discuss ways of developing mapping tools for virtual and digital, but other processes too, through notation techniques. So more insights to the topic will be given by Time's Up. Tim and Andy will tell you more about it later in a minute. Before that, I will just give some organizational input and the plan for today. The presentation of the lectures will be approximately 30 to 40 minutes. Today we have 2 speakers, 3 including Time's Up, but that'll be a short introduction. And so we will try to keep it to 30 minutes if possible. And of course, because we want to have a discussion afterwards as well. It would be interesting. So if everybody could just sort of maybe write down some questions and we can have, I don't know, we have like 20 minutes to discuss sort of more in more detail after the presentations. So that would be very welcome. Please do. Next thing. Oh, yeah. And from experience, everybody knows that one can get carried away with the presentations, forget the time. Here's a clock to look at, and I shall warn in a most gentle way by using this little mini thing, like this. So if it gets really severe, I shall use that. So the purpose of this, of course, is that we do have a discussion afterwards, and people who are here on this beautiful day will remain here and enjoy all the talks, the presentations, the discussions, the input, and hopefully there will also be some exchange in the breaks, which I shall announce. Well, there will be an input from Time's Up. Afterwards, there will be lunch, approximately at 2:30. At 3:30 will be the first speaker, Robert Rottenberger from America, the US, and then a short coffee break just to sort of relax a little bit again and maybe have a chat or, ask further questions if necessary. And then Elizabeth Schimana from Austria, she will talk afterwards. And, of course, again, we'll have plenty of time to talk in more depth after the presentation. And the evening meal will be approximately at 6:45. We'll see how it goes. My name is Noboria. I forgot to introduce myself, and I shall be leading you through the next 2 days. Yeah, and so I'll just pass on to Tim and Andy just to give us the input to the actual topic, the map and the territory.
Thank you. Thanks everybody for turning up today. We are using a microphone because it's all being recorded, so we can work out what happened afterwards. So even though it was a group like this, it'd be easier just to talk loudly. It'd just be good if we kept the microphones close to people, just an admin thing. And for those of you who are doing online electronic things, the public network isn't working the way it's meant to, so there's little bits of paper lying around that'll tell you how to get online, and it's working for some people, not for others. The Kepler Salon's being faced with a bit of technical details, so technical problems. So anyway, that's a bit of technical backup. I'm going to quickly give an introduction to a bit of an idea why we collected this bunch of people together, all you lot, and why we think this is sort of interesting, and a couple of the ideas of things that we'd like to cover in the next few days. So first, yeah, thanks for everybody for coming here. I get to be in a number of roles. Somehow I get to do the introduction, then I get to be part of Time's Up, and I sort of have to jump backwards and forwards, so hopefully I won't confuse myself and think I'm the wrong person at the wrong time. And just in terms of the data ecology series, one thing that's been really nice about them is it's been a really comfortable way to bring together people that we'd like to learn something from, people that we'd like to discuss things with, and to have really quite nice discussions with. So the series has been kept relatively small, and it's a little bit of a self-indulgence. So we're sort of enjoying it on that level, and we'll continue enjoying it. And one of the things that we're really looking forward to doing with the map and the territory is picking a lot of people's brains about ideas that they're using that we can hopefully use in our practice, and we hope that you'll all be picking each other's brains. One of the non-speakers, but very present person here is Gerhard Diermoser. He said no, he's not going to speak about things, he's got too much going on, but he's kindly brought some of his diagrammatic representations, first of his exhibition work, and secondly, an exhibition that's currently on in the Nordical called Erzähl uns Linz. So tell us the stories of Linz, or tell us about Linz. And this diagram over here takes the exhibition with how many pieces are in it? 600 pieces, and reduces it to a diagram. So trying to abstract out all the structures that are in this this exhibition. If any of you would like to go and see the exhibition to try and take this, to look at this map and then try and actually see what the actual territory looks like, at Nordico there's a number of prepaid tickets to go in and have a look at it. Just say you're from Data Ecologies. And Nordico is sort of around the corner, but we can point you in the right direction for that. So that's really nice. He's also left some of his resources, these two very thick folders over here, which have a huge number of examples of his diagrammatic research over the past, how many years? 10 years? 10 years of research sort of collected and assimilated. He said he's quite happy with people pulling things out to have a closer look at them if you feel like digging around. He thinks he can put them back in approximately the right order afterwards. Is that right? That's really nice to have that here, and the rest of the people who are here, I mean, he's sort of just speaking about their stuff. So, the map and the territory, what are we talking about? Of course, we have to start off with maps. Maps are one of these things that people love to talk about, in the whole Boyge quote. So, I mean, people sort of recognise all sorts of wonderful ideas about maps. I actually wanted to bring a globe to say that's one of the nicer maps of the world. But one of the problems we get when we're making flat maps of the world is like this. It's not really actually very representational. And one of the things that we always wanted to come back and focus on is the maps that we're making depend very much on what it is that we want to be doing. So these maps, a map like this has a certain meaning to it, and it's useful for certain sorts of things. Whereas if you're a navigator, you prefer to use a map like this, because the Mercator projection was invented so that when you're using angles, they actually kept making sense on the map and on the globe as you were sailing around. So depending on what you want to be representing is one of the important things to keep in mind when you're making abstractions. This one I found very pretty. It's based on a fellow called Cahill's work from about 1910, where he developed a couple of these types of maps that use different ways of laying the world out and breaking it in different ways rather than turning it into a rectangle, and focusing very much on the land masses and how they fitted together. And sort of for many of us, the land masses are the most important part. Of course, this became quite popular with Buckminster Fuller's representations of the globe. So the Fuller projection, which is all about the way that the land masses stick together. And so there's this particular map is looking at the ways that various sort of biomes are spread out around the world. And one of the things I found quite interesting about this is you see, for instance, the pink stripe of sort of the Sahara and the deserts of Central Asia all fitting together quite nicely, and it brings in sort of other parts of what's important about a map. For those of you who know some of the Time's Up projects, you'll know that it's not necessarily the land that's the most important bit, but Time's Up Boating Association is very interested in water. And this is from a guy called Spielhaus, who's from South Africa and ended up in the States for a long time. And he developed these representations where it wasn't about the land on the earth, it was about the water. That essentially the water masses of the earth are one unit, and the land is just sort of a bunch of borders. So in this version, you can very much see Africa, whereas America has been so distorted that you can almost not see it. And you've actually got Central America on the left-hand side of the map as well as in the bottom. That's sort of the Central America stretch. And these sort of maps are a very different way of looking at various parts of the way the world works. This one I also quite enjoyed, because if you look at the bottom, you can see the word Suez Canal, which runs from the bottom left-hand side to the middle of the right-hand side. So all of a sudden, the Suez Canal is really long. But if you only really care about water masses, you don't really care about the Suez Canal. It's not that important. So, these were some nice examples of bits of mapping. We could probably go on for hours, and one of the people that we would have liked to have had was like a historian of cartography to find out all the ways that different maps have been created over time to deal with different sorts of problems and issues. One of the things that if you take up hiking, you'll find that your maps are very common. People will draw red lines on a map, but a lot of the guides actually end up having these ridiculously long, complicated textual descriptions of how to take a path through the mountains, and I find them really annoying. I don't know about other people who are hikers, but this sort of thing is a quite accurate representation of a path through the mountains. It's just not very good for actually working out where you are, especially when you get a little bit lost. You're not quite on that map anymore. What is nice though is it tells you where the nice lookouts are, which on a flat map that you're looking at, they usually don't tell you where the nice lookouts are and where you should sort of stop to have a squiz around. One of the other maps that we're more interested in, and that's why we've invited people from Toxic Dreams to come along, is the theatre. The theatre does all this representation stuff by just using words. It's got this very classical way of using just words and lots of words to say what's going on. And something like this, where you've just got people, what they're saying, what they're doing, like intendances in the way they're saying things, is a way of reducing a really quite complex piece of theatre to a very simple, easily reproducible textual object. Probably works more easily because theatre is so textual, and you can just change things, and it's very much about the words. And I'm sure one of the things we're going to be seeing tomorrow as Toxic Dreams talk about this stuff is the way that when you begin to leave behind the textuality or this centrality of text, that things become more complicated to annotate, to notate, to summarise, to abstract. Of course, as you move into the modern age, away from our Shakespearean roots, the film has become rather important. For trying to formulate how a film is meant to work, the storyboard has become a very important part of that. So this is just some example. Liv's got something to do with Star Trek because I can recognise Spock in the top. But other than that, I'm not really sure what's going on here. But these sort of storyboards are filled with instructions for how cameras move and how objects move within these particular views, and are intended as a way of being able to communicate amongst the various elements of a film team in order to have a coherent idea of what's going to go on. This was a very strong background idea. We've been trying to work out ways that we can steal and use storyboard ideas for our work. This wasn't meant to be here yet. So I'll just skip it and come back to it. Talking about text in terms of theatre text and scripts, many of you will have come across computer programs that are often called scripts, especially in certain programming languages like Python or BASIC and other sort of languages like that. So code, of course, offers itself as a way of abstracting from something that happens into a bunch of code. Now, it's often, I don't know how many people here are programmers? No, you are. About half a dozen. It's very hard to tell without comments and without nicely labelled variables what a piece of code is meant to do. It's often very difficult. There's something that people make it even worse by using inappropriate variable names. And then there's something called obfuscation competition. So people try and make pieces of code that are even more unintelligible than they need to be. And taking that to its somehow logical extreme, you can then reintroduce aspects of code that transmit extra information without actually transmitting real information. This piece here is written in such a way so that it looks like a very simple labyrinth. And if you then compile it and run this bit of code, you end up actually with something that creates labyrinths, which we thought was sort of quite sweet. So all of a sudden taking this idea of you can hide things and make it very hard to work out what's going on, but in the way that this code is laid out, all of a sudden it's beginning to tell you what's going on, even though it will construct codes of arbitrary size just from that one little chunk of C source code. So code's also a form of abstraction, of map making, of trying to work out what's going on somewhere that we're all confronted with. One of the problems about it is that code is often so specific that you need to abstract away from it to be able to actually think about it in any way. Even like this piece of code here, it's very hard to try and work out what's going on. You can sort of recognize the dot underscore bin as, okay, that was an important thing that's going on. But trying to work out how to use this in any effective way is quite difficult. I know because I had to change something in it to actually make it compile on my machine, which is why coders have long used forms of visual abstraction, which is why I wanted to bring flowcharts in here. Flowcharts as being a way of saying you start somewhere and you're confronted with a bunch of decisions to make and things to do. This is, of course, a comical flowchart for people who but need to repair computer stuff, but it's still doing the essential things. You come somewhere, you then make a decision, you look at what's going on, you go somewhere else, and you could turn this into a piece of code, but this is actually much more to do with human behaviour. We can actually run ourselves, our little human behaviour, on this little bit of flowchart by moving around inside there until we've solved the computer problem. So yes, you too can become a computer expert with this flowchart. Another bunch of people that we don't have here, because I think we're mostly sort of humanities and artsy sort of people sitting around, is business people. Business people, if we want to regard it as in a somewhat unfriendly level, are often dealing with people who don't really want to read a whole lot and memorize a whole bunch of things. It's often said that one of the reasons that the stock market crashed in 2008 was because the mathematicians got in there and made everything too complicated, so that the meatheads who used to be able to run business quite happily were overly challenged by what was going on. So mathematicians are responsible. I don't know whether that's really true. I don't know of any mathematicians who will take responsibility, but maybe they did. What's often good in business circles is to have diagrams and ways of abstracting things so that it's easily followable. So this sort of flowchart diagram of what's going on, which we just took from I think it's a patent application somewhere, is often a very good way of describing movement of information and objects in space. Business like doing this sort of thing. And economists used to like doing this sort of thing. This is a very, very sweet piece of old technology. Has anyone seen this? Yeah, the water computer. It's basically this idea that money moves around as a form of liquid. It's a sort of this anonymous thing that will just move quite happily from place to place. And this computer runs a model of a national economy. It was developed in the 1950s by a guy called Phillips, who's a New Zealander, who ended up in the UK, I believe. And many things about it are actually instructional. I don't know whether you could actually safely model a economy on it, or even could have modelled an economy on it and got something that was useful out of it, but it was a good way of helping people see how things sort of fitted together, interest rates and costs of money and a whole bunch of other things going on. I also like this picture because the guy's got a really sort of 80s pair of pants, which is sort of a very economical time of the year, time of the last century. Going back to flowcharts and things, another bunch of like instructions and process-based things that people do are making recipes. People who can follow recipes are following, in some sense, some code, some diagrams, and an abstraction of the food that they're trying to make. Apparently, engineers have a lot of trouble following recipes, which is sort of a bit weird because recipes are relatively easily understood. So people have decided to have these recipes for engineers, and they've developed two main techniques for doing it. One of them is this, where you have the ingredients on one side, and the process of how you combine these ingredients over time, spread out, moving towards the right, which is an interesting way of taking something, an object, and talking about the way that you will transform it over time. Another one is this more sort of flowchart based way of doing things. It's not so much a flowchart as a data flow diagram. So for those of you who've used MaxMSP or Pure Data or other such languages, this sort of thing might look vaguely familiar as your bits of food flow through the kitchen from one place to another. It's like sort of data flowing through a PD patch. So these sort of levels of abstraction, it depends who you're aiming your abstractions to and where they're coming from. This afternoon we'll see more of this sort of stuff. This is some things that were collected by Smirnov. I always get his name wrong. In the Theremin Center in Moscow. And these are old representations of the music that was being conducted, created by Evgeny Shulpo, for early Soviet movies. And these movies were not being made by, the soundtracks not being made by orchestras, because that would have been sort of, I don't know, boring, a traditional way of doing it. They were investigating the possibilities of creating electronic music by taking the stripe that was being used to encode audio in talking movies, early talking movies, and then filling up the that tone with colour manually. So they were actually doing this manual tone creation. And this was their way of abstracting out what they were doing so they could actually compose, and then the people would sit down and make every single individual frame and the curves that needed to be made to make the sound come out. They look really quite amazing, these tone things, but you can't sort of compose it in terms of a bunch of notes because you've got very different abilities to make sound. So this is another one of the important things that we see about the way notation, composition can work. There's a bunch of people who are missing from this meeting that we would have liked to have seen here. Are there any comic people? Do anyone here write comics? No? Because comics are very much about abstraction, especially XKCD or very simple comics. There's very little sort of representation going on, but there's just enough to make everything work. Another thing that we're missing is technical drawing. People who do like the explosion diagrams of technical devices are looking at very instructive ways of abstracting all the machine bits out into these amazing diagrams. So I think there's a bunch of extra people who could be here who could have filled in a lot of stuff that we're not going to see in the next 2 days. But I think 2 days of conversation is going to be enough. And last but not least, the thanks. It's been very nice working together with the Kepler Salon as partners making this thing happen. They've sort of kindly invited us in here. One of the reasons we're here is not only because they're really nice, but out at the harbour, our space, which some of you know, there's currently a Red Bull Wake of Steel Bubble Days drama extravaganza going on. So if anybody needs some excitement tomorrow, jump in a taxi tomorrow and go down there and watch a bunch of people try and hurt themselves in the harbour with very high-speed cable water skiing gear and, I don't know, it's ridiculous. They've been building up. So we've decided to come out and hide here and do something that we hope is actually more interesting than watching people hurt themselves at high speed. And hope that you'll all have as much fun talking about and hearing about what's going on. This afternoon, what we're going to do now is Andy and I are going to now put on our hats as Time's Up and give you sort of Time's Up's perspective on what we've been doing with various forms of notation abstraction over the past few years, and also give you a bit of a background what we're doing. And then we'll talk a bit about that, so you've got a bit of a context of where we come from. Maybe it'll help a communication thing. Then we'll have something to eat to help sort of bring body and soul back together. Then we'll probably have the two extreme ends of the speakers for these 2 days. One end, we're going to have Rob talking about his material agency, which is in some sense for us like the overarching umbrella of what's going on here, the ways that agency can be communicated by and influenced by material objects. So that's in some sense a very abstract, high-level thing, which we're really looking forward to hearing about. And on the other end, we're going to have this very, very concrete problem that Elizabeth's been dealing with of how to take some of these very innovative pieces of electronic composition in the past 20, 30, 100 years and work out ways of notating them and getting them written down. So she's dealing with a very concrete problem. So in some sense, these two things form a really nice brackets for the next 2 days so that tomorrow we can fill up those brackets with a bunch of other experiences and probably realise that there's much in common between the problems that we're dealing with, but also lots of totally different ways about going about doing things, and we'll realise the conflicts and the totally different ways that exist. Good. So, thank you to Kepler Salon, and thank you to our our friendly partners, the European Commission in particular, who are helping support this sort of thing happening so we can all get together and talk random stuff. And now I'll take off my introduction hat and put on my Time's Up hat, which looks totally different, and pass on to Andy to start.
So is there any time left, Tim?
Yes.
And can you put on the other...
Oh, so you got another slide, please. Yeah.
Excuse me. No worry.
No, come on.
Good. Now we're Time's Up.
Yeah. So it's a pleasure to introduce Time's Up to you. For those who don't know Time's Up, I'll give you a short historical overview. We try to find a way why we ended up being interested in notation that much. Time's Up is about 16 years old or so, and there are various interests involved, very different people and approaches, and therefore one strength of the group is to get together all these ideas and get at one point to a goal and build something. And this was for the first years really huge media-enriched mechanical installations, playgrounds for adults and ridiculous things, but with a very low barrier to get people involved. So there were things like bicycles that did weird stuff, and it was like adults or people enjoyed it or tried or started to play, were really in our worlds, and had a lot of brilliant ideas how these worlds were choreographed or what kind of dramaturgic elements were involved. And so this was a topic from the very beginning, as you see in the small pictures, that the visitors always had to do something. And they got some reward too, and it was not only installational work, there was also a place for gathering, for social gathering, to discuss, have a laugh or a drink, and talk about different approaches and ideas of other people too. So that's mainly what I already said, so to say. We called them explorative narratives, and you see here a sort of notation, a way where we were from till 2007 or 2007, where we had the idea to build a whole city from this about 2,000 square meters installations. Was the idea to build, to start a project and build a whole city. And this project didn't happen, but it came out a lot of diverse ideas, different ideas. And there's one branch at the very bottom that turned out that narrative elements, we're more interested in that, we noticed in about 2009. And so we started to focus more on this branch, and that's what we are going to tell you a little later. But before we go back to these huge installations we did in the 90s and at the beginning of 2000, and Tim can give you a short overview of steps of notation that was already tried there or he found in his bunch of papers and materials, just to tell you how this looked like.
One of the things that we've tried to summarize our work is constructing these little worlds. So people explore these worlds. They're sort of like the real world, but they're sort of different. They work the same, except that they don't. And then people start to explore them. an anthropologist who came to visit referred to them as proto-scientists. They were coming in and they were exploring these worlds and talking to each other about what they were doing. So how do we go about building our little worlds? One of the things that Andy mentioned was these were very physical. And so, of course, when you're building a physical world, one of the things that's very easy to use is a map. So this is a very rough, sketchy diagram of one of the pieces that we did in 97. So this was the layout of a bunch of objects in what was it called? The space. Anyways, in part of the Ars Electronica 2007. And so basically just using this physical layout of the space enabled us to sort of talk about how people were going through there. There is a definite entrance. There was a movement from this entrance that had a function of separating people away from the groups that they came in, getting them to wear something. They had to walk backwards through this darkened tunnel, or they could wear like a little goggles on their face and a camera on their back with a light. So they could walk forwards, but they couldn't see where they were going, or they could walk backwards. Or they could turn around and look what was behind them, then turn around again and walk forwards a little bit, then turn around again. And this sort of thing, they could go through them. There was these get-goings. There was shadows going on. You can see these dotted lines in the middle showing that they could see through certain areas, but they couldn't get through them. There's that crisscross area at the top, which is like a ball that was moving around above everybody's heads on a big steel mesh. And people thought they were interacting with it. They were trying to put their hands up. They'd touch it. They'd make noises at it. And people had various ideas that it was reacting to them, moving towards them, running away from them, and there's sort of various explanations for it. There was a bunch of things that people were doing to move around. They could move up or go down. They could make choices in which paths they were taking. And then there's just two very like grey lines drawn on there. And one of them is between a piece that came at the very end of the experience as they went through this sort of network of experiences. There was this like one of those belts that people used to wear to like to wobble the fat off their hips in the 1960s. It was a very sort of classical fitness device. And when you had that on, you could sing or talk into this microphone, and that actually controlled the movement of the ball on top of that mesh. And you could see the perspective where the ball was going, but you couldn't see the people underneath it. So only through getting to the end and then seeing what you were actually doing, you sort of revised the story that you'd built up about what that silver ball was doing initially. So this is a very simple way of taking the spaces that we had and talking about people's experiences and the way that their experiences like correlated and went backwards and forwards. So this is I'm going to show you a very quick little micro video of the reality shifts, which was a piece that we built without any media in it whatsoever. It's essentially 16 cylinders. You can see pictures of some of them here that rotate around their own axis in groups of four using various handle devices. And as they turn, the doors from one cylinder to the next move so that you can cross from one to the other, and then you can't. The idea being that it was like a dynamic labyrinth. You had to get in there, twist, so you turn around, then the doors came somewhere else. You could walk back out into a new cylinder. So we talked about this piece, and we were like, okay, let's design it. And so you might have seen in that video there was a little graphic representation of cylinders turning in various patterns. Once you actually try and work out how to build it so that you can do the things that you want to do, it's really quite hard because you're trying to get them working together in certain ways. I have to lose the microphone now.
If you've got two of them, like match my hand, this is the entrance, this is the entrance. You've got two cylinders, have them like this, so you can get in on this side. Then you can turn, walk from one cylinder to the next. Then you can turn again and walk out. So there were walls around it, so there's only two entrances. You can think about that without having to use much more than hands.
So hand waving works for doing that. Once you start doing three, you can sort of imagine using your foot maybe as a third cylinder and do a bit more hand waving. But by the time you get to having four or more of these cylinders, you need to start actually using some sort of written down notation to work out what's going on. So I decided to avoid showing you a bunch of hand-drawn diagrams that we used to try and think about this, how it could work, and just concentrate on how they actually... a bit more of a nicer representation of it. So here you can see what we wanted to have was something like a block that people could walk into and out of. So there's another image. You can see a person walking from one to the next. And here's like a view above of one of the blocks. So we developed, by going through and looking at the possibilities, we looked at a group of four that were locked, chained together so that they rotated against one another. We realised it was important factors to keep into account. if you could get in to the block and then do something to come around, by the time you were going to leave the block, you should leave the block in the same state that you got into it. Otherwise, no one can get into it after you. That's sort of, it's obvious, but not obvious. So there's only one position in all the possibilities where you can get into and out of this certain block. And then we wanted to have it not be completely obvious how to get through. It should be a little bit confusing. So we looked at the ways that we could have these cylinders moving against one another. There was a safety concern that we didn't want to have the doors moving in contrary directions to one another. Otherwise, there'd actually be like a chopping action of two doors closing against each other, and that could hurt. We were actually surprised the first time we showed this that people got very competitive about rotating the cylinders, and we had to actually limit it to one, maximally two people in there at the same time. Curators, French curators, are the most dangerous and aggressive people once they get in a sort of cooperative environment. So it was actually quite intimidating. So anyway, we realised that we have to move them in a certain way, and we then looked at this and we sort of represented how we could actually move the cylinders around. So here you see the four positions as you rotate one cylinder, or each of the cylinders to each other, the different ways you can move from one cylinder to another. And then we looked at how we could actually build up a block. And this is a representation of the various paths that you could take through four of these things locked together. And in terms of mazes, I mean, most of us after the age of about two wouldn't be confused by a maze that looks like that. What was nice about it, the dynamics of having to spin inside it, is that you kept losing your points of reference, especially because there was lots of light just from above. You lost any lights from the side. Is we managed to get lost if we didn't really concentrate. So it was a cheap thrill for grown-ups. Was I going to talk about black box or are you? Yeah. Oh, okay. Good. So that was something very mechanical that we did. Trying to talk about some more sort of abstracted, more media-rich environments. This is a piece that we developed with Alex Davies, who's an Australian media artist and a lovely fellow. So you went into this completely black environment and there was a little pinprick of light coming out through a hole. And you could make your way to that little pinprick of light and look in, and there was a screen showing an infrared camera of you in this space. And so you could see yourself from behind. People would waggle their legs and look at themselves and realize they had fat asses or skinny legs or whatever they thought they were seeing. And then once you were there, in the screen, you couldn't see anything around you because it was pitch black and you'd just been looking at this light, so you were even more blind than before. In the screen, you could see people coming in, performers coming in next to you, and they would do a performance for you. The whole thing was phrased as you entered into this one-person's theatre experience. There was a back room where the actors and actresses performers were waiting, and they would come out and give you a unique performance. So here we can see Patrick Huber, who's a local performer, who came out sort of stumbling around in the dark and sat down and started talking to you over there. He knew where you were and he was talking to you, and then he'd move closer and go away and stumble and mess around. And of course you could only perceive this through the infrared business. So what was interesting about this is we basically had done all these recordings in a green box scenario where we'd set up everything to look exactly like the physical space people were going to find themselves in, and then had these performers coming in and acting like they were in the dark. So it was quite nice. Some people did it better than others. It's quite hard to act like you can't see anything when you've got lots of stage lights on you. But Patrick did it very well and a bunch of other people. And we wanted to be able to synchronize these things to make them work properly. There's no point having a video running if the person's not there. These sorts of problems. So as we sat around trying to work out all the things that could possibly happen in this space, and it's very simple. You can play a video into the screen, merging it with the live animation, live footage from the camera. The people can go in. They can be at the window. The people can go out. That's all that can happen. And even that took this ridiculous little diagram of all the possibilities that can go on. And this was a discussion. And you can see that there's the ideal thing and the bad stuff are the two notes at the top of the page, trying to work out what could go wrong and what was the right thing that were meant to happen. So we went through a process of abstracting this out to get a process diagram of what's going on, and so we could actually have the Max MSP patch doing all the right things at the right time, depending on what went on. And above this, you can see on the page, it's a bunch of numbers all listed, and that's all like a state machine trying to represent what's going on that the computer can actually keep up to date. It sort of worked. It's one of those things that sort of almost always works. But yeah, this is this process that we went through to make this all happen. Oops, no, sorry. So this was one of the more So simple pieces, but even that, trying to work out ways of discussing, just amongst two people even, what's going on and how we go about making things work the way we want them to do. How do we program the computers? What can go wrong? How do the sensors interact? Had this sort of ridiculous amount of notation. But at least this notation enabled us to agree on what we thought was going to happen and then to go away and be able to do it without having to constantly sit there and play with the one thing that we're doing at the same time. So after this, we developed a piece called Domestic Bliss, which was just shown around the corner here in the House of Stories, which Andy will tell you about.
Yeah, we did this project also together with Alex Davies. And it was a piece. I'll show you a short video of the setup where this installation happened. It was, as Tim mentioned, right around the corner, and we did this whole set. We wanted to have a story that played in the 50s. And it was, the story was about, it was a typical crime scene, so we placed it in that specific time. And we had a narrator on this small TV, so it was more or less the whole story told on this TV, and we wanted to invite the people to sit in the living room. You see this room back here? There is a cupboard on it, in it, and we tried to make people comfortable to sit in the living room to watch the TV, and we had certain aspects of different objects that were sort of interactive, but only a little bit, and were activated in a way within the story. So we, as you saw that the light went out, we did one stuff that we wanted to start rain and thunder, and so this was the start of the story. You see here spy cam. People went into it, wondered what happened there, and then they noticed or were invited by this narrator. She's in the, or we pretended that she's in the room next, where this cupboard is. She invited them to sit down and, yeah, to go into the story. So this was the first experience with concrete narrative storytelling. It was very linear. It was a story from A to B, represented via this TV and actors that are not here. We had cameras where we recorded it first, also this room. In this room then was hidden our whole technical stuff, really stuff with a lot of, yeah, you might know if you work in similar ways. And we wanted to see the people, the crime scene, and involve them more and more into the room. So we, as I mentioned, we started to create a kind of atmosphere that made it possible to dive more and more into it. So we tried to start rain and thunder, and we had all this electricity that we managed to flicker the lights then. And I don't know how long the video is, but she's telling the story of the crime. And people, the visitors, here you see the flickering light, visitors were able to go in all these rooms, in bathrooms and in the living room, of course. But it was not possible to go in this hidden room to see the narrator. So this was, it was more or less the start of our interest in this telling stories or how to tell stories. And from this project out, as many people told us, they don't know what it is. It's not theater, it's not cinema, but it's in a way a mixture, and it really tricks, because on a sunny day like this, people went into it, and there was a lot of rain happening there. Some of them, we noticed, one guy told us, shit, I forgot my umbrella. And then when he went out, he didn't need it anyway. So, but it was really like my experience was like in being in this tech room hidden and repairing something with the auto start of the installation. Having shaking this cupboard really tricked me as I was preparing some stuff and the story was going on. And then the cupboard shaked and I was in there 3 weeks to prepare all that stuff and it still tricked me. So we thought of, yeah, this is a way that we want to explore more ideas or get more ideas and let's think about it how we can end it up in a project. There are so many questions at the beginning of creating a story within a room. You see then here this reaction. People went away when the cupboard shook. And so we ended up in like semiotic stuff about objects. How does do objects relate to other objects? What should we use? Should we make it more passive or should we make it interactive? Where can we branch stories? Does it need a concrete story or can we just use MacGuffins or should every piece that is involved in this room have a certain meaning or not and how is the relation? And there were so many questions that we thought of, maybe we should get more into it and try to sort of develop a vocabulary that we, when we do it again, have the chance to not always start from the beginning. So just take one element that we know that this works, and if we need a focus on in this corner, we can get it via this tool. The interest in physical narratives. And so to say, we had this approach that we are getting more and more like a detective, and even if we visit some friend or private person, it's like everybody knows it. You go into it and you see a certain picture or a book, and yeah, you build your own story about everything that is set up in a room. And so this is what's mainly a topic for the next production afterwards that was mainly focused on different levels but was more or less not a story from A to B but had this, as I told before, like the first installation, it's very necessary that the barriers for people that they're very low and there are multiple levels for people to get involved. Either there's a book or a game or a video or something where we can approach different types of people to get involved in a story. And if you want to talk about 20 seconds more in detail.
I won't get into too much detail because time's marching on. Just very briefly, one of the things that we had here was for a science communication event at the university. And so we created this artificial scientist who started from some quite standard physics and mathematics ideas and went off in bizarre directions. We also wanted to make this very accessible to a large number of people, so we had a very standard presentation as if our fictional scientist was going to have a presentation. There was a mathematical genealogy on the wall, there were lots of papers on his desk, there were photographs of his people that he knew, there was an interactive three-dimensional hyperbolic pong game that you could sort of play outside to keep the kids interested. And all these things sort of fitted together. We had like these letters that were coming from fictional other characters in this little world, so you could really get lost. And when we looked at it afterwards, we tried to analyse what it was that we'd had in there. This is only a partial list of the objects and the experiences in the room. So we had things like a radio play that was going on in the background as if there was a radio transmission about non-university science and non-university research. Trying to work out the way that people could enter. So I think the red objects are like the bits where you might actually start to look at something, and the way that you would then move through this like network of objects and ideas in the room to explore the story world and to find out more and more. Because, of course, when we go into the room, you might be much more interested in the story going on the radio, because it actually appeals to you, and there's something going on about people who've dropped out of academia and are going off and doing something interesting. Well, I'm much more interested in this weird diagram and the way that ideas have flowed through the generations of mathematicians. These two things are then brought into relation so that we can talk to each other and then go to a third object and be able to explore it. So this was an attempt at trying to sort of explore the whole world of this fictional scientist. So with Stored in a Bank Vault, we took this a bit further. This is a thing that we showed in Brighton, and it's a heist that's going on. There's a group of people who are breaking into a bank, but you're not quite sure why. You come into this space, and they've all just left. One of them is hiding behind a door in a bathtub, washing himself after coming out of the sewers, because, of course, in the sewers it's not very nice, so he's having a quick bath to clean himself up and talking on the telephone. So you can hear him talking to people. You've got all these computer hacker stuff going on. You've got all sorts of bits and pieces like the forgery workshop, so there's a person there who's forging all the documents to be able to get into the bank. On the wall here, you see all these pictures of plan of the bank, how they're going to get in there, who they need to drug, who they need to distract, what time's the best time to do it. You can totally explore the world of this heist and then move down level for level. What are they stealing? It's not money. What? They're stealing seeds. Why are they stealing seeds? Ah, there's a biological setup there, and they're talking about the way these seeds have mythical properties. And then there's these bits of old photographs of pottery that go together to make up the story of these seeds mythologically. So there's many layers that you can sort of move down in bit by bit. One of the things we did here as well was for people who were coming in and were looking at things, to make it easier to find out why that particular thing was relevant, we were a bit naughty and we added extra information to Wikipedia. We didn't add fictional information to Wikipedia because that would be very naughty. But certain story elements that we wanted to have, we just put in there so that it was very clear that this chemical could be used for this purpose. So that if you quickly looked at Wikipedia to find out what this stuff was, you could very easily see what was going on. This was this ties in a little bit with alternate reality games, alternate reality narratives, where people are constructing these semi-fake universes that sort of dock into ours. And we found that to be a sort of a technique that might sort of help in the future. Lots of different layers. And the other thing we had in here was multiple timelines. So where in the domestic bliss, we had one big timeline from A to B, and then it started again. When we went into Stored in the Bank Vault, and the same with the 20 seconds into the future, there were lots of small timelines going around. There was answering machine calls, there was faxes arriving, emails arriving. All these story elements just arrived in multiple loops that sort of helped to refer to things. They weren't tightly synchronized. As opposed to In Tresor, which is a piece we did in Austria, where everything was totally bound into one big timeline and was very theatrical and sort of dramatic. If you were in a heist, you wouldn't actually have all these red lights turn on, but this was part of our sort of staging and scenography here. So we built this ridiculously complicated timeline in a programming environment called Xianix, which helps do these sort of cyclic patterns. And we're able to use this as a type of graphical notation to synchronize all the things that were happening on various computers at the back, emails arriving, chat rooms running, and these intruders coming. The intruders were a bunch of workers in the canals who would come up. You'd hear them first over the radio, and then you'd hear them actually underneath this door at the back. The back below that light, you can see there's a door, and then at some point they'd climb up to behind the door and shake it, trying to get out. So we wanted to bring this sort of dramatic moment right up to sort of these people who are exploring the space. So the latest piece is Unattended Luggage, which Andy will quickly talk about, and then we'll stop for some lunch, or some questions and some lunch.
Okay, it's as I thought about it, it was really funny to notice that we ended up from the big installations over to the idea of building a city, ending up with a small wardrobe in New York City. And this was as well good for us because we always extend things and always, more space is good. We can put that in and that in, and till the last day there is another idea that can be involved and let's build that. And so we were we had this small wardrobe and it needed so to say this was per accident get an idea together with this wardrobe. And as we gathered certain skills within this productions now, we tried to develop a story, a chronicle family story, so from the 1930s till now, and pack it into this wardrobe. there were very different approaches as well. We had a tiny cinema. We built episodes. We had five family members, and every family member had, so to say, a drawer. One was with the radio from specific radio shows from that time. What also gave us the chance to play with these multiple layers of storytelling, to have it in a chronicle way, or just by accident as people go through the different documents. But there are still a lot of things that we don't know, and as we keep going on to produce and hardly take time to reflect, we thought it might be a good idea to invite a lot of people who have maybe similar problems or better these problems and solutions, very good ideas that we can steal. And so I think this would be the start then for after the lunch to get your troubles and ideas, and maybe to get something out of it, and within the chat, so to say, get it nailed down to the way we want to build this vocabulary or an alphabet for these multimedia installations, where we don't have a certain clue how to start from where, because it's so many perspectives and ways, and we want to narrow it down in a way pretty soon. Okay, so thanks for your attention, and let's, if there are questions, of course we will answer them if we can. And
are there any questions, anyone? Oh, is everybody hungry? Looks like it. Okay, there's a chance to during lunch to ask questions if you have any, and further information about your Time Ups project. Yeah, we will start now punctually. How wonderful. And in an hour, at 3:30, we'll return to hear Robert Rottenberg's presentation. So, welcome to the next session, the next two speakers. Now we've got Robert Rottenberger from the US. He holds a professorship in the anthropology department at the Vincent de Paul University in Chicago. Also is a chairperson there. Which chair do you actually hold there? Chair of anthropology, okay. He teaches courses in the history of anthropology, anthropological theory, linguistic anthropology, urban anthropology, and nutritional anthropology. What is that?
Food.
Okay. His research interests have always been located in large cities. Every large city. Okay. And the question that guides his research projects is, what difference does it make in the way people think about their world and live their lives that they are located in a very large city instead of somewhere else? And his research has primarily been conducted in Western Europe, particularly in Vienna, in Austria. He's a producer of the DePaul Podcast Network, and that's still running?
Yes.
Currently, he is a coordinator of faculty advising for DePaul's College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences. His talk with the title Material Agency of the Map, that's the total title, will look at the meaning in objects in a historical context, describing rules and contexts that are passed on within everyday objects. Okay, well, thank you very much for coming, and let's start.
Thank you for the invitation. Is this the right distance of the microphone from my mouth? Yeah? See, I just got off an airplane, so my ears are still in bad shape, and I don't sound like this normally either, and I can't hear how I sound, so that's why I asked how it sounds to you. So when you hear the term material agency, do you think of Stephen King novels where automobiles and toy dolls suddenly become alive or inhabited by ghosts and run around killing people? Or do you think of musical notes lifting themselves off the score and manipulating the musician's fingers to make the right sounds? I ask this question because some of my colleagues, especially in archaeology, have a rather mystical approach to the notion of material agency. And to me, it really isn't that mysterious. Only human beings have agency. I really don't believe that automobiles kill people of their own will. And that's what agency is all about. I think it's people who kill people with automobiles. But that's another story. What I want to talk about today is the agency of the map. Because when I was reading the abstract of this conference, for some reason, I paid less attention to notation and more attention to the idea of map and territory and its and their relationship to each other. However, it came back to the problem of notation because you can't have a relationship between a map and a territory except through notation. So you'll find, I hope, by the time that I get to the end of my 30 minutes, that I will have said something about notation. You'll certainly see plenty of examples of it. Now, like a good academic, I wrote a paper. I will try not to read it verbatim because I actually at one time in my life was a performer. I still can do extemporaneous performance when I work at it. I don't know if I have the energy for it, but we'll give it a try. And I have a PowerPoint. So I want to begin by giving you an example of how material agency works. And what I want to do is I want to talk about an object that has nothing whatsoever to do with maps or territories or notation, just a simple object, something that all of us just used when we had lunch, which is a dinner plate. I figure that if we talk about absolutely everyday objects, that the reality of how material agency works will become far more apparent to us. So the plate holds our food, and it facilitates an orderly tidying up after the meal is over, and we call that the plate's function. When we look at the plate, we think of the food that it holds when we're eating it. But this is merely the beginning of the role of the plate in our social lives. There are three other implicit messages for us, and the messages change depending upon how the plate is being used and when the plate is being used. So there's an actual time series involved here which changes the message of the plate. First, the implicit message of an empty plate is, quote, "You are now free to arrange food on me as you choose, but don't exceed my perimeter. Stay away from the boundary of the plate, because after that, the food is on the table, not on me." When the food is served on platters at a table and diners can arrange the food on their plates any way they want to, no two plates will look the same. Many people feel that there are rules for arranging food on a plate. Certainly for some diners, strict separation of the different things that you're going to eat are important. For others, that isn't important. When the food is served on plates from a kitchen, the cook creates the arrangement and takes several features into account, like portion size or texture, color, viscosity, aroma. After the plate is filled, however, and presented to the diner, the canvas of the plate falls away to the food's figure. Just as with a picture on a wall, we see the painting, not the canvas that it's painted on. This is not yet the full extent of the plate's messages for us. When placed on the table in front of the diner, we immediately experience the plate's perimeter. the edge that separates our food from the food of others. The plate becomes an extension of our bodies. It doesn't matter that the food came from the same pot or that our forks or fingers have not yet touched it. The moment the plate is placed in front of us, that small bit of territory becomes as personal to us as the inside of our own mouths. While children may delight in taking food from the plates of others, adults can't get away with it. They have to respect the boundary of the plate. Only people who are on intimate social standing share food in public. And once this perimeter is acknowledged, like the initial canvas, it too disappears, and the diner proceeds to eat the food that is knowingly hers. But the plate's messages still do not end there. When the meal is finished, the plate circumscribes the waist. The food that remains on it is now transformed from the desired to the rejected, from food to dirt. Unlike the remains themselves, the implicit message of the plate at this moment is, wash me and reuse me. The plate's resilience as an object is never more evident than when it is ready to be washed. The message is washed away with the food scraps, restoring the plate to its initial state of being a canvas. Now, where do these messages actually reside? Plates don't come with a set of instructions. Therefore, they must reside in our comprehension of the plate, our experience of it as we have lived with these plates. It is dirty or clean, empty or full, set before the diner or stacked in the pantry. The substance of the plate itself is not transformed by our use, but we respond to it as if the messages emanate from the plate. But plates cannot talk. We talk for the plates. For this reason, material agency can best be characterized as a nonverbal dialogue between people about and through objects. Now, my goal today is to use this idea of a nonverbal dialogue between people to make our production and consumption of maps clearer. We can begin with maps that only take shape in language. That is, maps that have no material form other than the sound of words. In a classic article about how residents of New York City described their flats, Lind and Lebov, in 1975, discovered that all of the descriptions fell into only two types. The first type was some variation of the following. Quote, the bedroom is next to the kitchen, end quote. The second type sounds like this. Quote, you turn right and you come into the living room, end quote. These are labeled respectively the map and the tour. Now, in this particular study, only 3% of the people interviewed chose to describe their flats in the map style. All the rest chose the tour style. These two types of descriptions, the map and the tour, illustrate a long-standing and critical difference in how people understand their environment. Seeing versus going, presenting a tableau versus organizing someone's movements. The tour is more aggressive. It's a more aggressive dialogue between person and object. It limits choices and insists on keeping to a specific path. It makes sense that it would dominate in people's descriptions of their flats. They want us to see their homes in a specific series of impressions in a particular sequence. The tour includes effects. You will see that I have placed this picture on the wall. It includes limits. There's a step there, so be careful you don't trip over it. It includes possibilities. There is a door that opens to your left. And it includes directives. Look to your left and you'll see the view of the skyline. The tour produces a representation of the flat in our minds as the resident wants us to experience it. It brings the flat into social existence. That is the tour's agency. The map form of the description affords more choice for the person who's using it. It is heavy with positional pointers. Quote, this is next to that, or this is before that. But it is lacking in action or performance. The resident is saying to the guest, here's the floor plan. You may move through it any way you wish. The resident is in dialogue with the map as he presents the tour. From it, he selects the path and narrates the landmarks. The user is in dialogue with the map when using it as a map, without the benefit of the tour, choosing whatever path makes sense to him or her. That's the map's agency. As spatial practices, then, both maps and tours are dialogues about territory, but with different intentions to direct, modify, or augment an experience. Beyond language, we experience tours and maps as sensory representations of different kinds of space. All of these focus on important places or moments in a territory and leave out the unimportant ones. I'm always surprised at how many different kinds of time-based experiences can be described as maps and tours, and I want to focus on two of these that we rarely associate with spatial or time-based performances, namely wool and pastry. I hope that by exploring these unfamiliar and exotic territories, we will see maps and tours in a new light. Let's begin with wool. Cleaned, separated, and spun into yarn, wool is woven into garments by various techniques. The most complex of these fabrications is knitting, a craft practiced by hundreds of thousands of people throughout the world, and an art practiced by several hundred. The experience of knitting a garment is one that unfolds in time and space. The garment is the territory that is created as one moves through it, one stitch at a time, until the garment is complete. Knitting a single sock takes 20 hours and involves 13,000 individual stitches. Knitting a man's sweater takes over 200 hours and involves making 132,000 different stitches. In both cases, one starts out on a journey with a single stitch. After a while, the stitch pattern may change or the garment might require shaping, a feat accomplished by tactically increasing or decreasing the number of stitches in a row. Holes for the arms may require dividing the work. Heels may require special techniques to create the turn. The journey ends by stitching the various pieces together or closing up the tube. And since it is a journey with a starting point and a destination, it ought to just be describable with maps and tours, and indeed it is. This is a representation of a stitch pattern for a jumper, a Guernsey frock designed by the British fabric artist Kim Hargraves, as one would find it in a contemporary European or American instructions for the garment. This is a map. It is constructed on a grid where each box represents a stitch. The jumper is built up out of only two stitches, a knit stitch, rechte Masche, for those of you who speak, whose knitting is in German, not in English, that results in a bit of wool being pushed forward and indicated by an empty square on the grid, and a purl stitch, or linke Masche, that forces a bit of wool to be pulled backward and is represented by a square with a dot in it. These symbols vary a bit in different European languages, but essentially those are the only two stitches that most people ever use. It is the alternation between them that produces the brocade decoration for the jumper. The map begins at the lower right corner and moves row by row to the top left. This particular map superimposes the boundaries for seven different sizes. There is also a gap between the bottom edge pattern and the chest pattern. And in that gap, one knits row after row after row of just knit stitches until a specific length is completed. Then one begins the chest pattern. It would be possible to fashion the jumper using only the map. Doing so affords the knitter many more choices of how to accomplish the pattern. However, all European and American instructions include a tour of the territory of the garment that uses only words to describe the space. This is the tour description for knitting the back of the jumper. Like all tours, it is highly directive and removes options from the knitter. It assumes that the front and the back will be knitted separately and sewn together when completed. Knitters could knit both pieces together as a wide round tube until the arm holds. It invokes a knowledge of landmarks that are specific to the territory of jumpers, such as side vents, armholes, right sides and wrong sides, garter stitch and straight stitch. And finally, it connects to the map with references to chart A and chart B. The tour of the jumper is a document of the designer's knitting practices. Most craft knitters would follow her tour to the letter. Fabric artists would use her tour as a jumping-off point or an introduction to the territory of the garment. They would study the map and then adjust their tour to their own practices. The wool example has so far emphasized European and American garment territories. Switching to Japanese practices, we find that the map and the tour can be combined. This is a pattern for a vest. The annotations in English at the bottom were added by a Western fabric artist who was attempting to teach non-Japanese readers how to interpret the patterns. This is very useful for us as well. The map of the garment begins in the same place at the lower right. But instead of using a grid, we see that the external and internal boundaries of the territory only. The figure on the left is the back of the vest, while the one on the right is the front of the vest. The knitter knows that both halves of the front and the back are knitted together. The characters in the band at the bottom of the vest indicate a particular kind of ribbing. The numbers are separated by hyphens to indicate changes in the number of stitches per rows. As with the Euro-American tour in the map, this combined representation assumes that the knitter is familiar with conventions and landmarks. The chart pattern of the jumper is rendered as a formula, though, rather than as boxes on a grid. The amount of information available for representing the vest is vastly reduced, and more knowledge of getting around is shifted to the knitter. This pattern is far more map-like and requires more background knowledge and experience to orient oneself. Baking pastry is at least as old as knitting wool. Pastry connects us to the agricultural revolution and the year-round availability of milk and eggs, flour and flavorings. We all enjoy these confections, but few of us take the time to learn how to make them. Modern food systems take the effort out of these preparations, just as we no longer have to shear, wash, card, and spin our own wool. We no longer have to churn butter, grind and sieve flour, feed chickens, or collect honey. All of these ingredients are now the staples in any pastry are now easily purchased in a market. I want to focus on one form of pastry art, which is called in American the layer cake, in English a pudding, in French an entremet, and in German a dessert or Nachspeise. This confection involves layering different textures and flavors in such a way that the consumer enjoys a concert of tastes. In the hands of the home cook, this will simply be a flavored pastry cream spooned onto a baked crust of dough of some sort and topped with whipped cream, fruit, or some sweet sauce. But in the hands of a pastry chef, the entremet is the concerto of the pastry arts, often comprising five or more distinct layers of uncommonly combined flavors. The dish is a territory that becomes explicit as layers are created and assembled, And the journey ends when the confection is ready to be sliced and served. An example of a high-end entremet is one developed by Juliet Levchik, a chef instructor at the San Francisco Baking Institute. This is a spiced milk, chocolate-flavored meringue layered with orange-infused pastry cream and topped with a blood orange jelly. There you see it. The map of this territory takes the form of a set of recipes, one for each of the layers. The recipes include the form and weight of the ingredients and the method of combining them. As with the Japanese knitting pattern, the map makes assumption that the user knows what the various methods entail. One cannot whip cream, quote, to a soft peak, end quote, without some prior experience in the stages of whipping cream. Thus, the recipe is a map because it uses words as icons, as parts that represent an implicit whole of ingredients and actions. And navigating the map requires having been to similar places before, and therefore knowing how one gets there. Once the map has been read and the layers are ready, assembly can begin. Here the chef leaves the word-based map behind and employs a sequence of pictures of her actions that enable her to show us how the entremet takes shape. So we begin by spreading the praline milk chocolate ganache evenly over the hazelnut dacquois. You see the dacquois on the bottom there, and the ganache being spread on top of it. Then hazelnuts, chopped hazelnuts, are sprinkled over the ganache. Italian meringue is folded into the orange pastry cream mixture in three additions. The pastry cream is then spread over the ganache and the nuts and smoothed out so that it is flush with the frame. And finally, the jelly mixture is spread on top and the orange segments are arranged so that they evenly coat the surface. The entremet is then garnished with a bit of gold leaf and a triangular dark chocolate band to enhance the shine and to give it height. Now, the effect of these photos is similar to that of the tour. The chef, in selecting the shots to be photographed and published, is demonstrating the professional techniques required to construct the entremet, which, by the way, no professional chef would need. The resulting confection is out of proportion with the needs of a home cook, so the home cook can't use it either. The amount produced in the photo yields 20 portions. This would feed a large party or a pastry shop, but the proportions are not the only constraint of the tour. Very few homes would invest in a set of matching frame extenders of multiple heights. Notice the black corners in one photo and the yellow corners in the other. The yellow one is a shorter one that is placed on top of the black one. The frame is rectangular, a shape that lends itself to commercial baking but is not commonly found in home kitchens, and the photo shows most of the layers is finished. Only the lightening of the pastry cream is actually demonstrated. In fact, the photos represent the least difficult parts of constructing the dessert, assuming you have the right equipment. The more difficult parts, making a dacquois, the first layer, getting the ganache to the right consistency, or making a blood orange gelée that will actually gel and not run around, those require considerable practice. And that practice cannot be photographed. The photographs constrain anyone who wishes to make this dessert by only revealing how an experienced chef in a well-equipped kitchen would do it. She shows us only her version of the dessert, not a version we ourselves would make. Here we discover that it is not the time series itself that constrains the choices of the cook or of any designer, but the selection of practices and tools that are notated. That is where the implicit messaging lies. Maps, tours, recipes, and patterns are not unique objects. Instead, each must be seen as comprised of a set of places, stitches, ingredients, and therein lies a further complication in understanding their agency. The map and the tour is a politically constituted set. They are produced by one person to influence and shape the actions of others. To see this political potential, two French philosophers, Deleuze and Guattari, in 1987 suggested that we use the French word assemblage in place of the word set. Assemblage is a way of ordering and arranging knowledge that can occupy two different states simultaneously. It can be viewed as a whole, or it can be viewed as parts of a whole. The thinking here is analogous to the way in which we understand bodies. They too can be understood as wholes or as parts. When understood as wholes, the body occupies one kind of space and time, and when understood as parts, the body occupies a different kind of space and time. The whole is animate. It moves, and in the process of doing so, occupies and constitutes space. The parts are inanimate. The threshold that permits the parts to function as a body is their cooperation. More importantly, what distinguishes one body from another is the specific way that the parts work together to act in the world. This approach is less abstract than it appears. Assemblage is valuable as a tool of analysis precisely because it reflects real experience. I wish to take advantage of this with an assemblage that exists in every one of our lives to show how this tool works. I want to offer you a menu for a dinner party. I told you I was a nutritional anthropologist. Let's say that I want to make Chef Lelchuk's entremet for my guests. So I'm starting with the dessert. How do I go about creating the assemblage of courses that will highlight the dessert appropriately? Now, Chef Lelchuk has created a dessert that she self-consciously references as Spanish. She named it La Naranjita, the little orange. She combined quintessential Mediterranean flavors like blood oranges and hazelnuts with references to Spain's colonial past with chocolate, cloves, nutmeg, and cardamom. And to highlight the dessert, I want my guests to experience more of the flavors of Spain. To do otherwise, for example, to have the entremet conclude a Thai meal or a South Indian meal, would do violence to the flavor combination. It would render it meaningless. So to preserve its meaning, I want to preserve its context. For the creator of the confection, the context is Spanish. So I might start with some Kona almonds, cubes of Manchego cheese with slivers of guava paste, cured olives, and sparkling cave wine as the guests arrive. At the table, they'll enjoy a chilled tomato and apricot gazpacho and a fino sherry. A large dish of paella arrives, redolent in sausages, chicken, and shellfish. And aren't you glad I'm doing this after lunch? Rather than before. Its aroma of garlic and smoked pimenton fills the air, served with a manzanilla sherry. And finally, the dessert and the chocolate and blood orange entremet is served with a cream sherry. Assemblage is intended to be used as an analytical tool to help us dig beneath the surface of any practice and discover the different processes working in concert to give meaning and shape to our actions. The following observations belong to my practices and choices as a designer of the menu, and hence to your practices and choices as the designer of maps, rather than the experience of my guests or the consumers of the maps that you produce. First, this collection of recipes is an ad hoc grouping. I could invent several menus that accomplish a Spanish meal without repeating any one of the items that I've already given you. The origins of this collection are real. Each ingredient, each method of preparation, each wine is an ordinary food for thousands of Spaniards every day. Their rice, olive oil, wine, spices, fish are locally produced. They have many choices of what to eat. In fact, social relationships around the sources of these foods more often determine what flavors they taste rather than following a particular recipe. Since I'm not a Spaniard, I learned these recipes under specific circumstances in the United States, using my local ingredients and equipment, and at a specific time in my life when I had mastered some cooking skills but not others. If my food tastes like home cooking to a Spaniard, it's an accident. The rule underlying the collection, if it can be said to be even rule-based, is one of contingency. There was the opportunity, the means, the desire to make a Spanish meal, but there was no necessity, at least not the kind of necessity that a Spaniard encounters every day. Yet the origin of the meal in no way undermines or weakens the efficacy of it for constructing a Spanish eating experience for non-Spaniards. For my guests, what I serve them is a Spanish meal. Second, there are several ways in which this collection can be said to be coherent. The number and variety of recipes as a whole generate possibilities for action that go beyond any of the one recipes. It is the repetition of the Spanish theme across several different foods that build this potential. The collection permits me to choose this or that recipe. For example, gazpacho can be red, white, or green, and involve many different combinations of ingredients. Or I could mix recipes from different traditions. In Spain, however, these dishes are not understood as Spanish, the way schnitzel is Austrian or bangers and mash is British or the hamburger is American. Instead, they're understood as regional dishes. Manchego is, of course, from La Mancha. Paella is from the East Coast, from Valencia primarily in Catalonia. Gazpacho is an ancient and widely distributed soup based on stale bread, garlic, and olive oil. But in Spain, it is identified as a southern dish, primarily from Cordoba and Sevilla. Because of the strength of the regional identities of these dishes, they would not ordinarily be served at the same meal. To do so would violate the logic of the set for the Spaniard. Even the particular combination I chose for the paella would rarely, if ever, be served in Spain. They would prefer to focus on how a particular ingredient, the chicken, or the sausage, or the seafood, contributed to the overall flavor of the rice, which is what the dish is about. I violated the logic of the set even further by adding what, from a Spaniard's point of view, are random recipes. For example, the entremet is Spanish because Juliet Lelchek says that it's Spanish, not because it was ever eaten in Spain. Deleuze and Guattieri would identify this menu's tactics as countercultural, since they exceed and confound the coherence of the menu as it is ordinarily practiced in Spain. Third, each part of the collection maintains its specific history, which influences how I choose which of the recipes to work. My experience with Spanish restaurants in the U.S., the representations of Spanish food in the mass media, my assumptions that my guests have had similar experiences, these were the primary factors influencing my choice of menu. In spite of my efforts, each course had its own trajectory or movement through the web of food experiences, its own way of interacting and crossing the trajectories of other courses. These trajectories shape which courses will translate as Spanish and which will not. Gazpacho, in particular, can be confused with other cold vegetable soups originating in Latin America. Paella can and often is prepared in a way in North America that resembles other North American and Caribbean rice dishes, such as burgu or arroz con pollo. Deleuze and Guattieri would say that because of this ambiguity, the power of affect is not equally distributed across the assemblage. This means that the pervasiveness of the Spanish in each dish is not consistent. There is a middle ground of cosmopolitan knowledge in which a guest would be willing to make the journey to Spain through these foods, while those with too little knowledge or those who know too much would not. Fourth, there is no recipe that completely dominates the menu. In spite of my efforts to set up a menu to highlight the entremet, no one course has sufficient competence to fully determine the consequences of the activities of the assemblage as a whole. When I consider how I have worked with these recipes in the past, I recollect that each one has been served to other guests. I also recollect that at one time I served different paellas in four or five dinner parties in the same season. I was working my way through a specialty cookbook at the time. These are generalists, so to speak. The starters and the gazpacho have also served many different guests and were combined in very different main courses. I stopped cooking all of these dishes about 10 years ago, choosing to explore other traditions. The only reason I came back to them for this example was to give you a demonstration of a set. Finally, a particular set of recipes is a captured flow of objects for which organizational forms outside of my household are implicated. The organizational forms implicated here are present in the way this menu marks instances where breaks or divisions in otherwise free-flowing phenomena are evident. For example, my act of purchasing ingredients, some of which were actually produced in Spain, and dividing the ones I purchased from the much larger set of ingredient supplies that existed at the industrial firms who produced them before my purchase, from the retail store at its specific location and from its collection of merchandise, and in placing these stores in a pantry in my home. All of these were acts that broke these ingredients from their flow. The organizational forms that permitted me to capture these objects also include larger forms, such as the global market of food products, the lack of barriers to export and import, and, of course, the legitimacy of private property. That, too, is part of the assemblage. The food I serve my guests belongs to me. Before I purchased these ingredients, they were in flux. They were produced for purchase, but not yet purchased. They traveled to various places where they could be compared to similar products and bought. Such flows have always existed prior to any particular assemblage comes into existence. That is the moment when we can finally say that an object has been consumed, is when we take it out of that flow and place it in our own special collection. To sum up, Deleuze and Guattari call assemblages desiring machines. They move us to see ourselves and our relations to others in a desirable way. Solomon and Aziel observe that we put objects into assemblages because the whole unified whole carries role information. That is, for those few hours, my guests chose to believe that they could have been in Spain. It was theater, to be sure, but it was also a shared fiction that was made possible because the menu mapped the territory of Spain in their imaginations, providing a fanciful tour for their taste buds. To play the role successfully, the person cannot consume only one item, but must acquire the entire complement. We began to explore maps and tours as dialogues about a territory, but with different intentions to direct, modify, or augment an experience. And we did so by observing that all material objects, like a dinner plate, can contain implicit messages that direct or augment the actions of the people who use them. Objects enter into a dialogue with people, instructing them of the actions that must be taken. We then looked at patterns for knitting wool as examples of how this dialogue can unfold in real time, creating a territory that will ultimately transform itself into a garment. We noted that the territory is accessible through either the map, which offers greater options for action, or the tour, which is considerably more determined and channeled. Turning to Japan, we noted that a hybrid map tour tended to reinforce the constraining features of tours, while limiting the liberating qualities of maps. Both the knitting pattern and the recipe require a knowledgeable reader, familiar with the landmarks of the ingredients' quality, craft practices, and opportunities for side trips and excursions. Looking at the series of photographs of the chef assembling the pastry brought us closer to the ordinary experience of time-based media. These photographs show that it is not the time series itself that constrains the choices of the cook, but the practices and tools that are photographed. That's what I wrote down in the paper. It might have occurred to you, why are we talking about maps and tours in this way? And I think that the larger message that I have for you is that all design is socially embedded, that it's all about a conversation that the designer is having with his or her audience, and that the map or the notation, the figure that we create to document our design is a part of that conversation. This issue of material agency is about the conversation occurring at two different levels, an explicit level, which is the design itself, and an implicit level, which is all of these extraneous features and implied messages that are going on because of the way we've constructed the notation or constructed the map. It says as much about who we are as designers, who we think our audiences are as consumers, as it does about the subject of our design itself. And that's what I would offer you as a takeaway from this excursion into wool and pastry. Thank you very much.
I had it in my hand. I was being very generous about it. Any questions? Yeah.
It's not really a question. It's just I'm curious if you can explore for a second. Because I'm using, for example, in the net, I'm using this site called Cooking for Engineers, which has a real... And it's quite helpful. But I'm just curious if you can, in short, I guess... if I choose to put this dessert in a more mixed dinner, let's say, Thai, whatever, would the reading will be different, or you're just going to apply the same system, but just saying I'm creating a different map?
Any assemblage that you put together must of necessity be an ad hoc assemblage. It must, all of the elements will have a random element to them. No matter how hard you try to be consistent, the fact that you have to assemble them is itself an act of randomness, or forces you to have a random element. The only alternative would be to cook unconsciously. You know, close your eyes, reach into your pantry, take something out and say, okay, what can I do with this? But any attempt at design, whether it's in food or in theater, or in dance, or in multimedia, involves selection. And it is that selection which creates the assemblage, and an element of the assemblage must be random, according to Deleuze and Guattari.
I just have a question. How would it work with a food fight?
With a food?
Fight.
Food fight?
Yes.
A food fight interpreted as a performance would be one thing. The notation of the food fight is where the assemblage comes in. It's only when we try to document who threw what at whom that we run into the kinds of issues that I was talking about in my paper. In other words, I'm not talking about the design itself. I'm talking about the messaging around the design. Is that distinction clear?
Yeah, thanks. Very nice talk. I really enjoyed it. When you spoke about the people describing their apartments, I thought about how does your distinction between map and tour correspond to this concept of affordance that is embedded in a certain medium or in a certain physical
life. Affordances is architect language, unless someone are there disciplines use affordances?
No, so as you I didn't understand it quite well, but I thought that people were asked to describe their apartment. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, okay, if you give them an empty piece of paper, they would most probably rather draw a map instead of giving a tour.
Right.
And you spoke a lot about this kind of social determination of this narrative that is embedded. The question is, how does it, in your opinion, correspond with the determination is the wrong word, of the material itself.
Yeah, now, it's a very good question. I have a colleague who is an anthropologist who teaches in an architecture school, and she and I talk about this issue of where do affordances fit into this pattern quite consistently over the last couple of years, and we haven't reached a resolution on it yet. I think that the thing is that if you view, specifically in people's use of spaces, if you view the person who's narrating their experience of the space as embedded in that space, that narrative is going to generate affordances. If they are trying to do it in some sort of abstract response to spaces in general, you know, maybe not of their flat, but of some park that they've visited or a new public building that's opened for the first time and they're trying to describe it to someone who hasn't seen it yet, you're still going to get the map versus the tour distinction, but it's not going to be loaded down with all of the evaluations that residents usually make about the affordances in their particular space. Another way of talking about affordances is to talk about the way in which a space satisfies the life requirements of the people who occupy it. And that clearly gets bound up in the way in which they narrate it, because with the tour, which dominates 97% of all of these responses, that tour is about focusing the visitor's attention on one thing at a time and seems to duplicate narrations of affordances quite explicitly. Does that illuminate it at all? Good. But I got to tell you, I struggle with that myself. It's not completely clear to me. That's true of a lot of what I told you. There's a lot of this that I don't really understand that well. I'm still struggling with it. I've been working on this problem for only 3 or 4 years. It's part of a larger set of problems that I'm looking at that have to do with the social embeddedness of design activities in general across all of the design disciplines. And it's a big project. So it's proceeding a little bit at a time on a number of different fronts, and this is just one of those fronts. Right back at you.
But I think it speaks to perhaps some of the assumptions you have when you do your design, and also relates to what you were talking about. So when you had recourse to drawing and diagramming and map making, it was to prove control over a particular domain. So you wanted to make sure you had all the corner cases of your state machine worked out before you started coding. Right? And you did that a couple of times. And often when you produced a map on the screen, it was to embody control or transfer confidence or something. and to transfer the record of competence. You could execute anything pattern or deuce. And you have competence or the domain of making that select. And you talked at the end about design being bound up with issues of selection. You select the internal things together and discard some to edit. One of the things which then hasn't been mentioned, which is very important to what the map intended, is that I have recourse to map making to document discoveries in much more direct, to sort of name and locate and indicate landmarks that I have bumped into so that I might be able to find somewhere better. And that isn't something that maps easily onto your ideas of coding because you're very good. And there's the alchemy of cooking is something I don't understand very well, but I don't go into cooking with a sort of formal system that I cannot take through this path. We must simply implement and explore and then draw myself to maps that have velocity. So I wonder if there's a second sense of map making, a second sense of undiscovered territory that we need to respond to.
I always make a distinction when I'm talking about designers between designers who are concerned with craft and designers that are concerned with art. And this is just my distinction. I'm using these words in ways that don't make sense to anyone else except me. But you've just described what I consider to be the distinction, which is that as someone who is involved in design as craft enjoys replicating patterns over and over again and getting the same result. It's about consistency and it's about the perfection of technique and it's at the basis of everything that we do. We all had to be craftspeople before we could do anything else. But to use those techniques to explore undiscovered territory, the way a fabric artist designs a sweater. And I've talked with them, so I know how they do it. It's you just start knitting, and the yarn tells you what you're supposed to do with it. And if you make a mistake, if you interpreted the yarn inappropriately, you rip it out and you start over again. And the product of that can be extremely innovative. And it's the same with pastry chefs. I have seen pastry chefs labor for a year on a single recipe, literally adjusting the ingredients gram by gram until magic happens, where everything comes together. It's analogous to your experience of discovery, but it's in a different medium.
Just maybe adding to that sort of discovery thing. So I think maybe possibly the difference is between a map that shows where you've been and a map that shows the empty spaces, the white surfaces, that used to be there on maps of the world but don't really exist anymore. But when we go out exploring other things, trying to design things, yeah, we sort of find those little spots.
The ocean says undiscovered land.
The amount of undiscovered ocean, what's actually down there, how many mountain ranges there are underneath the ocean is quite amazing. But from a very different point of view, one of the places where I personally go exploring is doing mathematical research. And that is often about you go somewhere and you try a bunch of things out, but you try and then summarize what it is that you've done to be able to not have to go and do those same calculations and working things out again. And that's also some sort of mapping sort of thing to be able to reconstruct it. Is that what you were sort of meaning?
Okay.
Cool. So you left what?
Jet lag.
Is jet lag the magic word that means that everyone needs more coffee?
No more questions? Okay. Well, wonderful. Perfect timing. We're just ready for a coffee break. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, I suggest we start. I think there's only a couple of people maybe rushing up the stairs to get here from outside. Lovely weather outside, but we're all very excited here for the next speaker, Elizabeth Shimana. She's a composer, performer, and a radio artist. She studied electroacoustics and experimental music at the Academy of Music and Drama in Vienna, as well as musicology and anthropology at the University of Vienna. Her works deal with space, the body, and electronics, and she founded the IMA, Institute for Media Archaeology, an institute dedicated to the research of communication, of communicating artistic manifestations of technical hearing and seeing. That's what it says on the website. In German, I translated that. Is it correct? Yes, it's German. Anyway, her talk with the very sort of interesting title of Digital Nirvana, I'm very excited about what's going to be in it, will give insights to what code do we leave for the others, files, patches, and descriptions. And it might be something to do with creating maybe another language within music notation, and especially regarding electronic music. Well, thanks very much for coming, and we're excited about what we're going to hear next.
Thanks for the invitation. I do read from the paper. Ah, okay. Yeah. I do read from the paper because my English is not really good, so it's very helpful for me. Yeah. I called it Digital Nirvana. Just came up into my mind when I started to prepare this talk. And I was asking myself, what code do we leave for the others? Files, patches, description. In the long tradition of musical culture, a powerful tradition is interpretation. For interpretation, one media has to be translated into another. But very rare, this process is going on within the electronic or digital music community. Most of the time, the performer is the composer, and only she or he knows. So one could span a space from digital nirvana to grave symbols in stone. I'm gliding in that space. Terminology. Nirvana. The concept of moksha presupposes an existence of infinite eternal souls who alone are doer, enjoyer, and responsible for their action. Thus, all souls are entangled in the mundane, worldly activities bound to karmas since beginningless time and transmigrating and reincarnating from one existence to another. According to Jainism, all souls can bring an end to this repeated cycle of birth and death and attain liberation, that is, moksha, where there is neither pain nor pleasure, neither suffering nor obstacle, neither birth nor death, there is emancipation. Where there are neither sense organs, nor surprise, nor sleep, nor thirst, nor hunger, there is emancipation. Where there is neither karma, nor quasi-karma, nor the worry, nor any type of thinking, there is nirvana. There is a safe place in view of all, but difficult of approach. Where there is no old age, nor death, no pain, nor disease. It is what is called nirvana, or freedom from pain, or perfection, which is in view of all. It is the safe, happy, and quiet place which the great sages reach. What is the eternal place in view of all, but difficult of approach? Those sages who reach it are free from sorrows. They have put an end to the stream of existence. Digital nirvana is the place of all stored data. There is neither pain nor pleasure, neither suffering nor obstacle, neither birth nor death, neither sense organs, nor surprise, nor sleep, nor thirst, nor hunger, neither karma, nor quasi-karma, nor the worry, nor any type of thinking, no meaning. There is a safe place in view of all, but difficult of approach. The digital grave of a disappearing culture. We are out of cultural reincarnation. Pain or mercy? Tradition. The word tradition itself derives from the Latin tradere or tradere, literally meaning to transmit, to hand over, to give for safekeeping. It is presumed that at least two transmissions over three generations are required for a practice, belief or object to be seen as traditional. Tradition changes slowly, with changes from one generation to the next not being seen as significant. Thus, those carrying out the traditions will not be consciously aware of the changes of the change, and even if a tradition undergoes major changes over many generations, it will be seen as unchanged. So the main question is, do I want tradere, literally meaning to transmit, to hand over, to give for safekeeping, or is it enough to enjoy this one moment in time and space of a performance, an action, a common emotional space, an interaction? Assuming that you all store your data, the data will remain, but who can decode it? Give the data meaning, I would say even in the nearest future. So if I have the feeling that I want to leave something, I need to think about data translation and to find a language not depending on any particular soft or hardware. Notation. Notation in general is defined as written communication, a translation from one media into another, from sound to written symbols to sound. Music notation or musical notation is any system that represents orally perceived music through the use of written symbols. The earliest form of musical notation can be found in a cuneiform tablet that was created at Nippur, Iraq, in about 2000 before Christ. The tablet represents fragmentary instructions for performing music, that the music was composed in harmonies of thirds and that it was written using a diatonic scale. Because of conventional music notation limitations, many present-day composers in various genres prefer to compose music that is either not notated or notated only through a recording, through a digital recording. Now I switch right away from music to sound and into the field of digital or electronic music or sound. Their notation also includes the recorded sound piece. There are two main reasons for notation of sound structures in that genre. First, for analysis and graphical expression of sound structures. Second, for interpretation. For analysis and graphical expression of sound structures. One example is spectral morphology developed by Dennis Morley in 1986. Spectral morphology and structuring processes. He refers to the ideas of Pierre Schaeffer, who developed a typo and morphology to describe categories of basic characteristics of sound. It is a method for acousmatic music. Smalley distinguishes four steps in spectral morphology analysis. First, spectral topology, means from tone to noise, spectromorphological archetypes as a profile of sound, motion and growth processes, and fourth, structural connections, means the connections between different sounds. I just go back to what Schaeffer actually did. Schaeffer, in his book Dreh des Objets Musicaux in 1966, he were talking of layers of perception influenced by Henri Bergson, a French philosopher of the 30s. So you see the similarities of Smalley and Schaeffer. Perception first order. Profil général means the envelope of the sound. Perception second order, allure, means more or less the inner structure of the sound, so the little things which are going on inside of a sound. And perception third order, the grain, means the tactile sensibility. Stay here. Schaeffer's work at Institut National Audiovisuel, Groupe de Recherche Musicale in Paris, beginning in the late 1940s, culminated in the publication of the book Traits des Objets Musicaux in 1966. For Schaeffer, it never was important to create a written score. It was just the opposite. He believed in the recording as the perfect notation of acousmatic music. This even was a condition of his concept of reductive listening, which means to disrobe the perception of sound from everything which is not the sound itself. So the music has to be stored on a media to make repeated listening possible. Spectrum morphology was developed further for notation by Manuela Blackburn. Since its conception, Dennis Smalley's spectrum morphology has equipped listeners and practitioners of electroacoustic music with appropriate and relevant vocabulary to describe the sound shapes, sensations, and evocations associated with experiences of acousmatic music, of acousmatic sound. This liberation has facilitated and permitted much needed discussion about sound events, structures, and other significant sonic detail. More than 20 years on, it is safe to assume that within the electroacoustic music community, there is an agreed and collective understanding of spectromorphological vocabulary and its descriptive application. Spectromorphology's influence has been far-reaching, inciting approaches to electroacoustic music analysis, Thorsten 2007, notation, Patton 2007, composition and education through its flexible functionality and accessible pool of vocabulary. So this is how it would look like, this kind of spectrum of morphology notation. So like you would find a graphical expression for emergence, transition, release, or in this one you have a description where is the upbeat, the statement, the disappearance of a sound. And there are already several different kind of sound types which find in this graphics the representation. Mainly this kind of notations will be the score after. I mean, you make the piece and then you would find a kind of graphical representation of what is going on in the piece. So this is another example. You have a score for instruments and, let's say, a tape. So this is a score we know very well. And then here you have some kind of graphical interpretation, which I question because I think you don't really know what is going on. It's really an something just to represent in another media, but it's not for interpretation. Like we would have the score, the notes here is really for interpretation, but this graphical score is just a representation, which makes to me a big difference. another example. There you have notes, you have a spectrogram which tells you where are the frequencies in the spectrum, what is going on in the spectrum of the sound, and this is let's say the timeline, which is just the envelope, the shape of the dynamic, the dynamics of the sound. So, second, for interpretation. Interpretation in music is a very powerful tool. It's creating, it's redefining a given structure in endless variations, changing over time and space, depending on actual aesthetics and performance practices. So how to leave a structure in digital music for interpretation? Is it the patch, the script? I guess no. Software we experience nowadays will disappear. Systems, file formats too. They all go to digital nirvana. Technical development is fast. So I started to think about this fact. Till now, there are three quite different approaches I made. This is the Great Score. It's a piece called The Great Score, a project with Seppo Gründler I was working on from 2001 to 2006. The basic idea for the composition and its performances is rooted in the historical context of electronic music. The concerts follow a precisely defined structure, the score. However, the performing artists, Seppo Gründler and Elisabeth Cimana, don't proceed according to a score in the traditional sense based on notes, but due to a temporal and functional structure which was left to other artists for interpretation in the eighth concert. So what we did actually, we were playing seven concerts in seven different cities, and we always asked in that city where we performed two other artists for interpretation for the eighth concert. So what we left was exactly this bass structure, which means the performers do material creation in the first part, freezing means creating loops in the second part, and regulation in the third part. In parallel, the computer would do data acquisition, which means there were certain moments when we were creating where the computer would record parts. And during freezing, the computer would analyze these recorded parts. And in the third part, the computer would play the synthesis of the analysis. So it means we are on the beginning, actually, of electronic music, where the composer only sits there and is doing just like, you know, regulating the sound. But the whole process was going on during this one performance. And so there was also a visual score. So this was the visual score for part 1A, and it was not like this. It was drawn during the time, during 28 minutes. It was drawn. So this would give us the sign that the machine is recording with this black. If we were performing, I mean, you really could feel now it's the moment that the machine will do the recording. This is part two, so all these little rings, they also were just coming one after the other during 21 minutes of the freezing part. And this was the image for part three. So it looked somehow like this. This was the performance in MAC in Vienna. We had this really nice opportunity to do the projection from the top. So we were actually sitting on the screen, and this was very nice, because then you don't really need the clock or the watch. You really can feel the light on you, and you know exactly where you are in the piece. So as in the eighth performance, we had all these different artists in different locations, and we did this net concert as a Kunstradio project. So we and Seppo and me, we only did the mixing for the radio, for the live radio show. And so I play now just really the synthesis of the synthesis, because it's the synthesis of all the performers playing. Whoops. Approach was really to try to leave a musical score for flute and live electronic, and to try to find a language for a live electronic musician for interpretation. It never happened till now that I find people really to interpret, because usually all these people do their stuff themselves. They don't really want to interpret someone else's things. I think this generation of musicians, they don't really exist till now. And so, yeah, I wonder if this would be enough information to do an interpretation, no matter what kind of technology you use. So the idea was to find the terminology. If you do it with analog things, or with a MX patch or reactor or PDE or I don't know, whatever, it shouldn't make any difference. So I will try to. So this would be the notation of the first part, and I just play a little bit of this. Maybe, so to explain a little bit about this core, I mean, this is, of course, there's a hidden layer of phrases from Heinz Thesa, which he is an architect, and then you have what a flute is doing, and then what the electronics are doing, and how the sound has to be spread in space, and there you have the agenda, which signs, which symbols mean what, so kind of very classical notation of a piece. So, and the last approach is a series of works I'm working on at the moment. It's called Virus, where the media is this core from sound to sound. It's a composition for a life-generated electronic resonating body, and in the first case it was a string quintet. I did a mutation for oboe quintet and another mutation for piano solo, and the next I'm working on will be for two drum sets and five brass players. So the situation is that I do generate the score live, and the musicians need to play what they hear in the moment. So the musicians all have sit in front of a speaker, and it's really this reaction in the very moment, and it is really fantastic how fast we are, and in terms of sound, perceiving sounds, react to sound, it's milliseconds. Really. And it's a very, very deep concentration process, because you really need to follow each millisecond what is going on. So actually you don't have time to think. It's not allowed. It's forbidden. You cannot think. It's impossible. You just can react. So I end up with the paradox, no translation from one media into another. The media itself, in this case the life-generated electronic sound body, is the score for interpretation in the very moment of now.
So, anybody any questions? Everybody stunned.
So do you think that there will ever be a notation for electronic music?
I'm working hard on it. But yeah, it's the question, you know. If it's needed, if we do want it, if we do want to go on like one performance, one composer, or if we want to create a language which we can leave. That's the main question, you know. And I had the feeling that I want to do it, that I want to leave something. Because what I find so nice in music, that actually interpretation is really creation. It means that maybe in, I don't know, in 20, 50, 100 years, people will do it in a totally different way. But still, there is this kind of structure you leave. So I don't know.
But I was thinking more, not only in leaving something to somebody else later on, but more on inventing something. And if you can formulate it, or if you can write it down, then you could come up with different things than standing on the computer and doing it, because I usually get lost doing it. And I would need something to restrain myself in writing down beforehand what I'm planning to do, like planning a tour through a dark wood, where I want to end up in the end. But if I don't have a notation for this, it's really problematic, because then I usually get lost in all these possibilities and all the options of sound. And yeah.
You mean more to write down the concept, or what you said you need to write down, then to have more control over how you are going to realize it? I think that's some similarities what Tim said before. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but this is something different. And the other thing is really the question to leave something.
I know, but it's essentially, it's more or less the same, because if you can describe, because we just don't have a language even to describe sound really properly, I have the feeling. No? Or can somebody, like, How would you do it, and how would you describe?
There's just many languages you can describe using all these languages together will in the end form like a language or a notation of future music. Future music, music's always changing. You said you don't know how music is perceived in 20 years' time. We perceive music different to like 20 years ago and 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And it's all these factors. You wouldn't be able actually to write down the simplest digital produced music in its full content, because it's you would have to write down so many parameters. If you create a pop track on Ableton, for example, and you have a let's say 3, 4, 5 filters running.
But that's something you can't do with any music. It's always an abstraction, and it's always needed the cultural background, which you need to that's maybe something what you said with this, what all the design is embedded in. So any kind of score is embedded in cultural practice. And if you don't trade the cultural background together with the notation, of course, no notation makes sense at all, you know. Mm. So we need this, and this was something I was thinking about to find. I mean, we have terminology in electronic music now. We know what is a frequency, what is a gate, what is filters, what is this and that. We have terminology. I just really think, if at least I think about to do that, to get rid of specific software, because that is disappearing. Or I cannot read anymore the stuff I've done 20 years ago. It's the medium. I have it on floppy disk or even on older disks and on tapes which appeared for maybe very short time. It's gone.
But you have the recordings.
No, because it's on the media which I would really need to have a lot of effort to get the machine to read it.
Do you know what's going to be possible one day? It's like you have the recordings from like 20 years ago, and you will sort of analyze these recordings. You will end up with the different samples. The sort of you've built out all the samples you have, like you transferred into MIDI signals again and stuff like that. It's definitely possible. You will definitely sort of do kind of a data mining on music in like about 10 years' time, I guess. But already.
Yeah, probably.
Just on that thread, this, maybe it's a reinterpretation thing, and you were talking about like pop songs. I think maybe one of the criteria of abstraction is, can you play the song that you've heard on a very different instrument? Like a lot of these pop songs that you can turn around, and even though the fuzzy sound of a Beatles guitar or something has got missed, you can still play a version on a ukulele that's recognisably the Beatles song. And how much does that work? This is this whole interpretation question.
Yeah.
Just
I think there's a big difference between classical notation and this Klang, I don't know how to Klangfarbe stuff or timbre or something. Because of course we have this classical notation which is great, and you say there's the sound of the piano, and it plays this kind of melody. And that's crystal clear, because we don't have to describe the piano. Because if you would have to describe the piano sound...
But this is crystal clear because of hundreds of years of developing, you know?
I think it's
so, and we are just on the beginning, really.
No, I think it's crystal clear because we know the piano sound, so we don't have to describe the sound. And we notice the sine tone, and we can say, okay, play this note melody on sine tones. It's also, this is the terminology we have in electronic music. But then, as soon as you start changing the waveforms to some ever changing stuff, then we are completely lost. And and if we add up all the languages we have, then we as well make the song as it is. We don't have an abstraction to it. And that would be the question: are we capable of some time to make an abstraction, or do we have to make the song as it is? And
or just to record it.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
but then you always need really to take care to copy it to the new formats. You continuously are busy with copying it, you know, to any new formats which are appearing. And it's going very fast. I mean, it's going really fast. And so actually I think that's what I was thinking. Somehow this digital culture will disappear. I mean, it's many things will disappear. Even we are able now to store everything, so much data at the same time. Life is very short, I guess. So maybe to grave in stone again stuff we really want to transmit to the next generations.
Do you think music is actually, you can reduce music to basically two parameters, or maybe two kind of systems? The one would be the notation, that would be the algorithm, the Handlungsablauf.
Yeah.
And the second one would be the tones.
You mean
the sound.
To describe the sound.
The sound, yeah.
The sound.
And
because
like the algorithm sort of trigger the sound. But is that the basic idea of music, or
basic,
is that
it's
never going to change, I guess.
No.
It's like that Persian at the beginning of your talk, how do you call it? The what?
The Kunafon.
Yeah, exactly. Just basically invitation didn't change.
Basically, is it that you have a timeline, and I mean, we know so many things that you even don't really know, you really need the timeline, because there are different concepts.
Yeah.
There are concepts in graphical notation where you just have some symbols and you as a performer decide yourself in which time you are going to perform it and things like that, you know. I mean, it's just really for what you said in electronic music, because we are not only busy with the time structure, we are busy with the sound itself, and that's maybe really the biggest thing to think about. You know, how do we describe the quality of sound itself? So there were some approaches. You know, how could you describe the quality of sound? You know,
and what the influence of the sound is on the time structure, because the quality of the sound has an influence on the time.
Yeah, sure, because if you have a sound which needs a long time to develop, sound is time.
Mm-hmm.
There is no way out of time in any way.
Yeah.
So we are always talking about time.
Mm-hmm.
I found it interesting you said that composers don't like to interpret other people's work, and that
nowadays,
and that, you know, the pre-modern notation is all about reinterpretation. And I was trying, I mean, I know this is a completely different thing, but with all the remix culture and sample culture, so I asked myself, what is the role of representation or notation in this case? And I'm wondering whether, okay, if you're looking at the kind of remix process where the actual file itself becomes its own representation, and maybe not representation, but as a means for, or a vehicle for reinterpretation. So the notation becomes more intellectual exercise of analyzing, describing the sound, and not so much as a kind of utilitarian mode or possibility just to make it possible to have the same piece shown or performed in different points in space and time.
I mean, this is really, let's say, the coming out of Pierre Schaeffer's approach, that the actual recording is the score. You don't need anything else for that. But as soon as we start to work with acoustic instruments or things like that, you know, then we are in a different situation, because this is not pre-recorded. This is actually done in the moment, or live electronics is done in the very moment. So there we have to think about different things. But what you were talking is perfectly what was going on and developing since Pierre Schaeffer's first try to work only with the Platte record, with the record, and to make the loops, to close the Rille means to have a loop. So we are still there. It's still going on, this kind of culture. But there's also this other culture developing with really producing stuff in the very moment. And therefore, I think it's worth to think about notation.
I have an interface question. Is the diagrammatic interface of a complex software-driven instrument a notation by itself? Or that's a new form of notation?
Maybe I don't really understand your question. So
I think I had a little bit the same question, that if you think about the Pro Tools interface, in a way it kind of fulfills the same purpose like, let's say...
What is the Pro Tools interface?
No, I don't know. Just the kind of graphics of the track.
If you work with Pro Tools.
For example, yeah.
If you work with Pro Tools, you are already in the machine.
Exactly.
So what is the interface to the machine?
That this is a kind of equivalent of a pre-modern...
The mouse, or what do we have? The keyboard, or what...
You have everything. 700 functions and a graphic representation of these functions, and you are able to use these methods. And it's very easy to record this, because it's with software, and these are all defined functions and methods. And
it's a simple
instrument, and that's why you don't need this new complex notation.
I'm just going to answer your question about the guitar. I think it's like a particular configuration of the interface is the guitar. So.
Yeah, but I thought we now you're already confused. I thought we're talking about notation, and then a notation for an instrument. And I understood the electronic instrument with lots of parameters is the instrument. And I mean, in a certain way, maybe the instrument gives a notation, but I wouldn't think that the instrument already is the notation.
Yeah, I think maybe there's two layers of notation. One is the notation of the sound produced by the instrument, and the notation of how to construct the instrument. Because I think one of the things about generative music is that you're as much playing with the instruments themselves or the systems that make instruments as you are playing with the sounds that they produce. So maybe one of the reasons why you don't have these or why it's very hard to interpret any of these spectral notations is that you have to actually design an instrument to do it. And there's no instructions about how to either configure an existing instrument or design an instrument that will produce those particular spectral patterns, or conversely, come back the other way from it. If that helps.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the graphical interface itself is not enough of a notation to produce specific outputs. So it's like a range of possibilities that you still have to limit in a very particular way to produce a particular set of possible songs or musics or sounds or whatever.
But I think there's a difference in notation and score.
Yes.
The notation is a possibility, it's a code, and you have defined methods and defined functions, and I think this is near the code term, and that's not the score.
Yeah, so I was suggesting maybe there's these two layers of description. One is the score for producing the music, and one is the notation for how you describe the instrument that produces that music. And the sort of behind that you have the space of possibility, which is the code that is notated. Oh, no, the code that you use to make your interface. But that itself is not a notation. That is not the notation of the instrument or the notation of the score, but the notation of the thing that can produce the instrument or the score. More or less, yeah. Is that clearer? Or does it help?
I have a different angle of attack. What do you, as a composer, want? So, 100 years from now, someone discovers something written down, non-oral, that is your composition, looks at it, and then plays something that is yours, plays something that is good, plays something that is theirs, plays something that is useful to them. What is it? Which of these outcomes is satisfying to you? Because I think that constrains what it puts some limits on what it is that you want to specify.
Yeah.
Can I actually I just
find it interesting, and it's more an observation that in the end what you said was basically I want to leave something for And basically, I think this is the exact question then. And I just find it as an observation. It's kind of nice that it went now. It came 30 years later, 40 years later to this discussion that I want to leave something for somebody to interpret it. It's interesting.
Yeah. Now, it just, then it's exactly that I leave a structure or a description of a structure which is able to interpret with totally different tools in 20 or 30 or 40 years, you know. Because all these tools, DigiDesign, whatever, they will disappear. I'm sure, you know. But it is possible to leave a structure. And how, if I think about this, if I really want to do this, because I'm always switching in between to have the pleasure to do things just for now, and to think about, do I want to leave something, and how do I make the description? Because I'm sure even in 30, 40, 50, 100 years, people will understand frequency, phase vocoder, FFT filters, things like that. I'm sure they won't disappear, you know, because this will somehow be part of our cultural heritage. That's what I just think, you know. So how to find a language just to say, okay, it's about this. And then the nice thing, of course, is with now. Mendelssohn was the first who brought Bach, you know, 100 years, 200 years later, yeah? And now we are playing it. We are able to interpret it. I'm sure it didn't sound like that when Bach was playing this. I'm pretty sure about that. But that's exactly what I find so beautiful, that this really very nice potential of interpretation connected to the actual aesthetics and cultural, I don't know what to say, thinking at a certain time. Yeah, but it's joyful,
yeah,
in a way. It's nice. And it's you, and still it gives you some kind of input. It's just this kind of input. Yeah, inspiration, input. So, yeah, mainly that's the thing.
Right, yeah. Well, yeah. There's inspiration.
So
it's
name and royalty and leaving something.
Huh?
It has nothing to do with that.
With what?
Name and royalty.
No, nothing.
The history
books. No, nothing. For me, not. I mean, I don't know. Not for me. I was really thinking more on a kind of cultural level. What is? Yeah. What?
Maybe quick question. One of them would be, I don't know whether you're familiar with. I think it's called Zeitkatze.
Zeitkatze.
And they essentially reinterpreted a lot of electronic music for classical instruments. I'd be interested how they went about doing that. And the other question has to do with, is it that everybody who's doing this sort of electronic music has just picked up a punk sensibility, and it's all about just doing it yourself, and no one really cares about playing other people's songs in much way that... most sort of independent bands don't bother playing covers unless they totally reinterpret them. But most of the time, it's not really based on that at all. They all want to do their own thing. And has that just infected contemporary e-music? So maybe that's two different questions.
Okay, if I go, let's say, to the, let's say, more classical-oriented contemporary music, we have education. We educate violinists, piano players, whatever, but there, at least I don't know any kind of real education of electronic musicians, not electronic composers. You have courses for electronic composers, but the education for electronic musicians just is not existing. Do you know some education? It's not existing. So the question is if it will come in the future, you know, that we have the same kind of education like what we have for acoustic instruments. I don't know. So that's one thing. As soon as this will appear, we will have people who have fun to do interpretation and not only to compose their own stuff. I think it somehow goes together, you know. So this, the one thing. What was the other thing was?
Just an experience whether you know what Weikatzer did in order to create their interpretations.
No. I know that they did it, but I don't know how they did it. But I think mainly they also were working. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on now already to find ways to do interpretation. Also, for example, for Marian Amashe's stuff, you know. So people are really thinking about it, how to do it, you know. What did she leave? How can we understand? So there will be a workshop in Berlin in July exactly for that topic, you know. So I think it's coming. You know, it's really coming, these questions, you know. You finished?
Just one, maybe just to hang on to that question, there was the fellow who ran Stame for a very long time, whose name I can never remember.
Michel Weisitz.
Who died like
2 years
ago. Who
died, yes.
Yeah. They were developing, Stame developed lots of musical instruments, all sorts of weird interface technologies. And for his own practice, he froze his hardware. I think about 15 years ago, he never changed the actual hardware. At a certain point, he didn't change the hardware he worked with because he was spending all his time designing new hardware and couldn't ever learn to be virtuoso with that,
yeah,
with the actual stuff that he was using. And through that process of learning how to use that properly, he got to be extremely good at using precisely that. I think maybe that's one of the things that you were mentioning, Nick, that there's so much design of instruments going on, or you get lost in the possibilities of sound, that you never can get actually good at playing an instrument in any sense. All you can do is get good at manipulating things with software, and then a new software package comes along, and all of a sudden you're concentrating on learning how to use that in strange ways or to do the same things as last time. So really there's no time to learn to be an expert in some sense.
Yeah, I know this. I know Michel from, I was at Stein when he still was alive, and yeah, that's exactly what his opinion was, really, to stop, to have every 5 minutes a new instrument. Really, like in the old, really, to go very deep into one thing. You need to practice, of course. That's still like, it's still, yeah, still like that.
And just maybe a last connecting thing, because you were talking about assemblages beforehand, and it seemed that the middle piece, I think that you showed, of the three pieces,
yeah,
was very much an assemblage of different things that had classical musical notation, had the spectrographic stuff, text, notes, and physical placement of sounds in the room.
You mean this one?
Yes.
Yes.
And a bunch of extra.
So this has notation. Just the, I mean, it's very hard to read, I guess. Yeah? I mean, but, yeah, so here you can, I can give it to you. So the booklet is the score. So the score is on the booklet. So if you are interested, you can have a look at it. Yeah. Just then, if you are interested. And then you will see. And I would really be very interested, especially of people who are working with, dealing with sound. Can you read it? Would you understand what I have written down? Would it make sense for you? You know, this would be a very, very nice feedback for me, really. So if you could do that, I would be very happy. Yeah.
We actually originally had planned to try and do a evening of reinterpretation performances, like basically the one night between the 2 days. The symposium, but organizationally that became somewhat difficult.
Yeah.
But it sounds like
it would have been really a nice thing, yeah, to have really to give it to. And of course, what you have additional is the recording, so you get an idea, so you of, you know, at least how it sounded in one performance, which most of the time you have anyway, a kind of how to say.
Anything?
A reference, a kind of reference, yeah. But anyway, it would be nice to have an interpretation, yeah.
Homework for all the musicians until tomorrow. We need a version.
Good morning. You know, the musicians, they don't read you out. They don't read you, because they're not musicians, they're composers.
composers never redo other composers.
It's also not true, but it's very rare, really very rare.
Well, rearrangements they do, don't they? Like arrangements of someone's piece for a new thing is often given the composer's, the arranger's name. So maybe that's what it's arranging.
Well, it sounds like we've come to a natural end of the discussion. We can continue with some refreshments, I think. Still here? Yeah? I don't know if they're still there. Anyway, thank you very much for your very exciting talk. I, of course, I'm not a musician. I ask myself the question, would I invent another kind of symbolic language that wasn't a graphic one, that maybe would be something like a recording, a sound or whatever, or just text or somebody speaking? I mean, I'm sort of always amazed that in music everything is sort of very strongly related to graphic interpretation. So I'm always, they seem to be stuck in it somehow. And that's why the thoughts I had on this subject. So it'd be interesting to see what different kinds of people might come up with that is other than maybe a graphic interpretation of sound. Anyway, that's the final word from me. Thank you very much. And again, I'll just one wish before we go. If all the speakers could give a copy to the organizers of their presentation, it's for the documentation. That would be very nice. That's also for tomorrow. If everybody's going to speak tomorrow. And yeah, I'll just say quickly the agenda for tomorrow before we go off and enjoy the rest of the evening. Tomorrow it starts at 11 o'clock. There will be the first speakers will be Toxic Dreams, followed by Mark Downey. And then we'll have Kate Secure. There's no lunch on my sheet. When is lunch? Oh, yeah, there it is. Yeah, 1 o'clock, sorry. I didn't want to miss lunch. So 1 o'clock is lunch. Then is Kate Secchio. Secchio, is this correct? Yeah? Thank you. And then Herbert Lachmeier. There'll be a coffee break at 4:30 will be the last speech and then at the last presentation. And at 5:30 there'll be the final discussion with a short summary of the day. Actually of the symposium. So, yeah, and anybody who's joining the evening meal, do you have everybody's name or do you need anything regarding them? Yeah, there's a possibility of a... For those who don't know, there's a joint meal organized for everybody, so who wants to join this meal? Well, the final instructions. Yeah, because I don't know the place myself, so I can't even tell you how to get there. So, yes. Hidden. It's a new place for me too. So thank you for attending and being so attentive and discussing so vividly, and we see each other tomorrow. Thank you.